going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Going the Distance podcast presented by ImmaculateSports.com. Twitter's at ImmacSports.
Instagram is also at ImmacSports.
TikTok, YouTube, Immaculate Sports. It's episode 223, and it's another big one. It's kind of the biggest time of the year for sports where all these different groups of people are coming together for very different sports, and we're going to try to talk about all of it. Baseball, we got free agency and trades. It's been very crazy. We're going to go through most of the trades that have happened and also some pretty good college football playoff first round matchups. We got our picks, of course.
Yeah, it should be a fun episode, as I think I always say when we do this part of the episode. Yeah. But top 15 power rankings, as we always do, bi-weekly, that is. And then that will be trade grades for the biggest trades that we've seen so far. This past week for MLB trades alone, I think it's probably been one of the most exciting non-trade deadline weeks in baseball in our lifetime, I would say. So it's pretty cool to see that stuff going down. It felt like you kind of just had to be glued to your phone or on MLB Network to see the next thing going down, because the winter meetings, there was a lot of shit going down, which was awesome to see, which I guess leads me right into my opener. Where I'm talking about Jeffrey Springs going to the A's. We'll get more into our official opinions, I guess, as we go through the trades, and we will grade that one on both sides for the A's and the Rays. But it felt good for once to see the A's actually add someone via trade. Usually you see the A's are trading and it's our best players going somewhere else. Now, I mean, and it's not like Springs is the Rays' best player, but we're getting, you know, solid player to add to our roster. In a time of need for the roster where they, you know, want to add talent, and seeing them actually do that and not just say that they're going to do that was really cool to see. And I think Dave Forrest has done a pretty good job so far in this October, or not October, this off season.
Also definitely one of the better things that I saw this week. Very well put. We're usually the one giving away all the real value, and now it's us getting the guaranteed major league guy right away in Jeffrey Springs. And we'll get into that later. The best thing I saw, though, was the Jets barely hanging on to beat Jacksonville 32-25. By far the best offensive showing from this team in years. Rodgers looked healthy for his first time as a Jet. Devontae and Garrett are just running wide the fuck open once again, and A-Rod finally had the time to get it to him this time. I was a tank for Trevor guy in the past, and I'm sure he's going to figure it out. It's not about him, but I'm okay with the Jets finishing 7-10 if it's possible, because most of the building blocks are going to be coming back next season. It's not going to be a hard reset unless Rodgers doesn't come. It's more of like a, you know, CJ Mosley is probably not coming back. John Franklin Myers is still not filled, but we're going to take the most disciplined player that we can find. Those guys usually come from Michigan, Georgia, Bama. I'm sure they'll be in the trenches, and we'll get into more mock draft stuff as we get closer. But that's basically my weekly breakdown of the Jets. We still need a GM.
Going on as we speak, because it seems like every other day there's a new Schefter tweet that I get of, oh, the Jets interviewed this guy, as we get those day by day now at this point. Moving on from that, though, we'll get into where you're head at, and starting off the way that we always do with our player, defensive player, and rookie of the week in the NFL. We'll get started with the player of the week, Skyler. This one seems pretty easy, just like it did last week, too.
I'm actually going to go with co-winners again. Lamar Jackson had 5 touchdowns, no interceptions, basically the closest you can get without a perfect passer rating. But it was the Giants, so there's also Josh Allen. He just put up 48 points in Detroit. That might as well have been a perfect game, too. Over 400 yards, 4 total touchdowns. This is your MVP race right here, folks. I feel like I should mention both of them because it's pretty even at this point.
Yeah, completely valid to mention both those guys. What they both did on Sunday was pretty remarkable. Obviously, I think Josh Allen's getting more of the national media notice right now because he did it in a big-time game, and that a game that they won by 6 points against one of the best teams in the NFL, and Lamar Jackson did against the Giants. And that's no slash. I'm kind of team Lamar here in this situation, but I did end up going Josh Allen for my player of the week, 23 for 34, 362 passing yards, 2 touchdowns through the air, 2 touchdowns on the ground as well, too, as part of his 11 carry, 68 rushing yard performance in there as well, too. 10 touchdowns over the last two games for him, five rushing, five passing. And then he had a receiving touchdown the week before that as well, too. So just the crazy stuff that Josh Allen's done has definitely propelled him to be the favorite in the MVP race as of right now. But as I said on my Twitter last night and some other things, maybe this race shouldn't be as one-sided as it is right now. So Josh Allen doesn't get my player of the week, but shout out to Lamar as well. On to defensive player of the week.
I'm going Nick Bonito, Denver Broncos edge rusher. He's having a fantastic season, and he made two of the best plays on Sunday from a defender in a big win over Indianapolis. He had a half sack that forced a fumble, and then that game-sealing pick six on a trick play. Nick Bonito is just one of those guys we get every year. He's a little undersized. He played in the Big 12 for his college career. Can we really trust him to turn into a good pro? And it's working so far.
Yeah. I did also go with Nick Bonito as my defensive player of the week. They ruled it a forced fumble for a touchdown, which I don't know how they did that because I thought it looked like a forward pass to me on what Josh Downs ended up throwing right into Nick Bonito's like in stride hands going the other way for a touchdown. But I guess they ruled it a forced fumble. It would have been Nick Bonito's second pick six of the season. We saw him get one. Was that last week or the week before against Cleveland on Monday Night Football? So he's been having a good year, not just scoring touchdowns, but he's, I believe, over 10 sacks now at this point, got a half sack on Sunday, has become one of the best defensive players in the AFC. On to the rookie of the week.
I'm going Brian Thomas Jr. because I was probably one of the only people to actually watch this entire game. Sauce has definitely gotten his groove back, but the guys opposite of him in relief, Isaiah Oliver, Kendall Sheffield, they got torched by Thomas 10 times, 105 yards, two touchdowns. I've mentioned this before, but after watching another full Jags game, I think I can confirm they'd be 0-17 without Brian Thomas. So he gets my rookie of the week.
Yeah. I went with Jaden Daniels for my rookie of the week, a close victory over the Saints, but Jaden Daniels looked good, 25 for 31, 226, two touchdowns through the air, as well as 11 rushes for 68 rushing yards as well, too. You can make the case that Jaden Daniels could have had a lot more in this game as well, too. He missed Terry McLaurin a couple of times when he was wide open for touchdowns, which would have made it about a 300-yard game with four touchdowns. Maybe some of those other passes wouldn't have happened, though, so who knows exactly what the numbers would have been, but would have been a massive day for him and McLaurin. Regardless, they still get a victory, big victory in New Orleans, and Jaden Daniels is been performing, so he's my rookie of the week over some of the other rookie of the quarterbacks. On to our top 15 power rankings. Been an interesting couple of weeks that we've seen here since our last ranking, so maybe some shaking up towards the top. We'll see how it goes. But we'll start off with the teams that did not make it that were on it last time, if you want to talk about any of them.
In the past 4 weeks or so, whenever the last time I did this, Arizona, Atlanta, and Miami all got a little worse, lost a couple divisional games. Those guys are not in the top 15 for me anymore.
The only team off my rankings is going to be Seattle. They were at number 13 for me last time. Now they are completely off of those rankings. Loss against Green Bay wasn't really the thing that changed it, but Geno's injury is definitely a thing that kind of worried me. If he is out long-term, then obviously they're not going to be as good as what they were in the first 12, 13 weeks of the season. So Seattle does fall off my list, which brings us to number 15. And who do you go with there?
I went with the Chargers at 8-6 to start us off. What a disappointment against Tampa. They're obviously downwards from the last time we talked about this, destroyed by Baker and company. But hey, all they got to do is beat Bo Nix on Thursday, and we all forget about that. I would kill to have their schedule this season, that's for sure.
Number 15 for me is going to be where I put the Cincinnati Bengals. I did this a couple of weeks ago as well, too, where I had them at the 15 spots and then took them off this last time, and now I'm putting them back on at the 15 spots. So coming up from an unranked, they have two good wins against the Cowboys and the Titans. I know those teams aren't anything crazy, but they're still technically in it now at this point. If they win out against the Browns, Broncos, and Steelers, we're talking about them potentially being a playoff team with some other things needed, of course, as well, too. But they're playing good football as of late, especially on the offensive end, as they have the entire year, with just Ja'Marr Chase and Joe Burrow being on another level. Number 14.
I did keep Seattle in the top 15. Not great against Green Bay, of course, but they already swept the Cardinals. That's a massive advantage. They could get into the playoffs with just one more win over the Rams. Not bad under a rookie head coach. It's just all about that quarterback. So far, it's okay. They're still ahead of a couple of teams here, like Arizona, so I didn't bump them out yet.
Number 14 for me is where I put the Los Angeles Chargers, sitting at 8-6 right now. Losers of two in a row, and in the stretch of some pretty bad football the last four games, their only win being over a Falcons team that they needed four picks from Kirk Cousins to win by 4 points. So it wasn't really the greatest showing there. They go into a tough Thursday night game, but a must-win game against the Broncos, which will be a pretty boring game to watch, but a big game as far as playoff implications go. They moved down two spots. I don't know if I said that or not. Number 13.
At 13, I got the 9-5 Washington Commanders because they have some work to do before the playoffs. Luckily for them, the matchups aren't as difficult coming up. But the last time I ranked them, since then, these guys lost three in a row. They've done some great things this season, but I'm not sure I'd predict them to win a playoff game on the road or anything like that. So I'm going to keep them in the bottom half here.
Number 13 for me, moving up one spot, is going to be the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. They're at 8-6 right now, and winners of four in a row, playing some of their best football in the season right now. 37 win over the Giants, 26-23 close game overtime victory over the Panthers, and then these past 2 weeks, pretty good win over the Raiders, and then a dominant win over the Chargers, and a 40-17 win against a defense that has been one of the best defenses in the league this year. Rest of the season for them looks pretty easy as well, too. Cowboys, Panthers, Saints. If they win out, they win the division. And I would not be shocked to see them sitting at 11-6 going into the second week of January. Number 12.
At 12, I got the 8-6 Rams. I don't love the way this roster is built, but they've done what they had to do. And they're the only team in this division to not fall on their faces completely over the past month. They got the Jets, Cardinals, and Seahawks coming up. I wouldn't be shocked if they go 10-7, at least.
Number 12 for me is going to be where I slot the Commanders. They do move down two spots despite back-to-back victories. And it wasn't really as much as their fault as some other teams just playing some really good football recently and them just kind of being really close against the Jake Kaner / Spencer Rattler Saints on Sunday kind of scared me a little bit. So they do get the two wins. They do go into the last stretch of the season at 9-5, which is way better than what we expected. But a big game against the Eagles on Sunday, not really for divisional purposes, but definitely for some seeding purposes in the NFC. So Commanders number 12. On to number 11.
At 11, I got Tampa Bay way up here because they crushed the Chargers on the road. That was pretty impressive. And they immediately become that team to beat in the South with how bad the Falcons look. I kind of like the teams that trend upwards right before those last couple games.
Number 11 for me is going to be where I slot the Denver Broncos, winners of four in a row. They don't move up or down in my rankings. Considering I thought these past 2 weeks are kind of interesting for them. They played a weird offense where they were just chucking the ball down the field against the Browns. And then they got some weird fluky plays against the Colts to win that game, whether it was Jonathan Taylor dropping the ball or Josh Downs throwing that weird pick six forced fumble touchdown to Nick Bonito. Regardless, they win, you know, two straight there and four straight in a row now at this point. So Denver sitting at 9-5 going into that big game against the Chargers on Thursday. Number 10.
At 10, I got the Houston Texans at 9-5. They've had a hard time winning the ones that they're supposed to this season. So I think they've been passed up by a couple of teams now, but they already won that division. This isn't really something they have to worry about, right? Just the seeding coming up.
Number 10 for me, my biggest mover up in my entire rankings, up five spots, is going to be the Los Angeles Rams. Winners of three in a row, four out of their last five, with their only loss being to the Eagles. They beat the Bills in that crazy game that we saw 2 weeks ago and at this point, and then played the exact opposite type of game against the Niners in a rainy, gritty Thursday night victory against their divisional opponents. Like you said, they really feel like the only team that hasn't fell on their face in this division. I thought that was a pretty good analogy. And everybody talks about the Bills being so red hot. They just beat them. So how can you not like this Rams team right now? They're going into a pretty big stretch of their season, though, with the Jets, Cardinals, and Seahawks, three teams that are – I mean, the Jets aren't in it, but they're still a respectable team, and some aspects. And then the Cardinals and Seahawks after that, two divisional games. So still a lot left to play, but the Rams are trending upwards, probably the most out of any team, in my opinion. Number nine.
At nine, I got the Denver Broncos, probably my highest risers of the past couple of weeks here. I didn't write them all down just because it's been so long for me, but their defense is playing out of their minds right now. Shout out to Vance Joseph, comes from that Todd Bowles defensive tree, and they may not all be great head coaches, but they definitely know how to shut down top quarterbacks. They almost got that win against Kansas City a couple of weeks ago, and another team that's definitely trending upwards. You'd like to see it. Not you personally, but the young quarterback with the new coach. You like to see it.
Yeah. Number nine for me, moving down two spots, is going to be the Green Bay Packers. Winners of four out of their last five. They split these last 2 weeks, a loss against the Lions on Thursday Night Football, and then a win on Sunday night against the Packers. Or not the Packers. They are the Packers. Against the Seahawks. Last three games of the season, Saints, Vikings, Bears. I like them to get at least two out of three out of those. And be a 12-win team going into the playoffs, which won't be enough for the division, but it might be enough for the sixth seed, and maybe not even the five, which is kind of crazy to think about. Probably not the five, actually, when you really think about it. But on to number eight.
Yeah, here's where I got Green Bay. Pretty big statement win in Seattle on Sunday night. Jordan Love playing much better in the second half of the season. And the big thing is Josh Jacobs, right? If he keeps scoring in the first quarter multiple times, it's pretty hard to come back on that defense too. Some pretty good pass rushers. So they're set. They're going to be in that 5-6-7 range for sure.
Yeah. Number eight for me, not moving at all, is going to be the Baltimore Ravens. Past 2 weeks, they have a loss against the Eagles, close one at home, and then a big win at the Giants this past Sunday. Last three games of the season go Steelers, Texans, Browns. Two of those teams they've already lost to this year, and the divisional teams, and then Texans on Christmas. Texans obviously trending upwards as well, too, with their most recent performances. So tough schedule to end out for the Ravens, but if they win on Saturday, I believe it's not Sunday for them, against the Steelers, they are going to be in a good spot for the division, I'd imagine. On to number seven.
Yeah, at seven's where I got to Baltimore. I agree they're playing more like a complete football team again, but you got to beat Pittsburgh, so I'm not going to put them over there. One thing to note, though, they are relatively healthy compared to normal for a Week 15-16 matchup.
Number seven for me, I have the Pittsburgh Steelers. They moved down two spots in my rankings. A good win over the Browns the week prior, but that game against the Eagles, they just – I wouldn't say they quit, but they just didn't have that fight in the second half. I believe that the – game-ending series for the Eagles was like a 10-minute drive, 21-play, like just massacre where they just got 4 yards, then 4 yards, then 4 yards over and over and over again, and they just didn't get the ball back the last 10 minutes of the game, which was pretty discouraging for a defense that seems to be one of the best groups in the league. And they have a tough schedule the rest of the way through. They have that big game against the Ravens on Saturday, the Chiefs on Christmas, then facing the Bengals team in Week 18 that could be fighting for a playoff spot as well, too. So downwards trending for the Steelers, but I still like this team a lot, especially if their defense plays well over the next 3 weeks. Number six.
Yeah, here's where I got Pittsburgh. So we're pretty close here. Like I said, I couldn't put them below Baltimore. They have that head-to-head, and most of the time, that's good enough. But it's really weird to see them get out-toughed. And I actually think that says more about Philly, and we'll get into them in a little bit here. But, yeah, the first time Russell Wilson's looked human this year. Definitely not a great look, that's for sure.
Moving up three spots to the number six spot for me is going to be the Houston Texans. They wrapped up their division on Sunday with the win over the Dolphins. Winners of two in a row, three out of the last four. That win over the Dolphins really felt like a big victory for them to move up a step. I know the Dolphins haven't had the greatest year so far, but they've been playing good ball out of late. Felt like a potential upset. And the Texans, I think, played a really good defensive game. And got the job done when they needed to. They go into this last stretch of the season, Chiefs, Ravens, Titans. Titans they already lost to, so I guess that means something, even though the Titans are probably the worst team by quite a wide margin. But these next 2 weeks, Chiefs and Ravens, split that and you're good. You already got a playoff spot, but it would feel a lot better if you're not the four seed, which is always a tough spot to be in. On to number five.
Starting off the top five, we have the 12-2 Minnesota Vikings. I really like what they're doing so far. It's finally time to move them back up in this group because they played basically every top team really tough on their schedule, whether it's San Francisco, Green Bay, Detroit, the Jets in London, because it's you never know what happens in a different country. But Sam Darnold has played really well. Helps when you have two really good receivers, too. They got Seattle, Green Bay, Detroit coming up.
Number five for me is also going to be where I slot Minnesota, moving up one spot on my rankings. Winners of seven in a row now at this point, but the last 2 weeks felt very comfortable, which is kind of a difference for this Vikings team so far this year. At least in the first five games, that win streak, there weren't a lot of close victory, or there weren't a lot of, you know, spread out victories. But 21-point win over the Falcons and 18-point win over the Bears is exactly that. They control their own destiny in the division, which I think is really cool for them. And that's obviously something that they wanted. Potentially a game of the year, week 18 matchup. Probably would be Sunday night for the division, Lions versus Vikings. I don't know if they went out, if they would get the number one seed, since Philly would have the same record of them. I'm not exactly sure what the tiebreaker situation is there. But controlling your own destiny is exactly what you want, and I'm sure that's what Kevin O'Connell is preaching to his guys right now. Number four.
At number four, I got the Detroit Lions, also at 12-2. I wanted to put them right next to Minnesota, kind of because I guess we're all hoping for that Week 18 Last Supper game for the division. Yeah, the first time they haven't been in the top two for me in a while, and I am a little worried about their defense. Not necessarily their chances of winning the NFC, but winning the Super Bowl, yeah, I'm worried.
Yeah, number four for me is also going to be the Detroit Lions. They moved down three spots from the number one spot that I had them in a couple of weeks ago. The next two games, Bears and Niners, they should win pretty handily, but that game against the Vikings is obviously the big, you know, circled one that they have in there. It sucks with this team. I mean, I think everybody's rooting for this team to, you know, at least, you know, make it to the Super Bowl, whether they win or not. People have their own opinions, but it sucks seeing this team go through so many different injuries, whether it's Monty McNeil, Carlton Davis. The stuff that they just had this week alone was ridiculous. And obviously it makes their defense a bit subject. It makes their offense a bit subject now, if not having that David Montgomery, you know, just consistent force in the backfield. Obviously, Jahmyr Gibbs is probably the better back, so maybe it sparks their offense even more with Gibbs getting the ball 25 times a game instead of 15. But they do move down three spots because of the injury. So number four spot's a new home for the Lions, unfortunately. Number three.
At number three, I got Buffalo at 11-3. They've given up a ton of points this season, but when you can beat Detroit at their own game, things must be going pretty well. Don't forget that these guys are still undefeated at home this season. That'll probably stand deep into the playoffs, too. Nobody wants to play there in January.
Buffalo's my number three spot as well, too. They actually don't move in my rankings because they are 1-1 within the past two games, even with that win over the Lions. Their defense allowed 44 points 2 weeks ago and allowed 42 points this past week, so not the greatest showing on that end. Regardless, they still get a win in there due to how good Josh Allen's been at quarterback and these other weapons as well, too, really coming on as some strong targets and useful pieces for Josh Allen to get the ball to. Next three games, Patriots, Jets, Patriots, they should be fine, and I would be shocked if they lose any of those games. And being 13-3, they should be a two seed in the AFC. Not a bye, though, unfortunately. Number two.
At number two, we got the Chiefs. It was a nice couple-week run of them outside the top two, but they're back because we're seeing the same script as usual every year. They want us to worry about Mahomes' ankle. They want us to worry about the loss to Buffalo. But the truth is they have far less issues than all the other AFC teams who can't stop a nosebleed right now because this is a dominant defense.
Number two for me, moving up two spots, is going to be the Philadelphia Eagles. They now hold the longest win streak in the NFL at 10 wins in a row. Something interesting about the Buccaneers, because they were the last team to beat the Eagles, yeah, they also beat the Lions. So pretty high credential victories for the Bucs this year. Regardless, great win for the Eagles this past week against the Steelers. It was kind of close the week prior against the Panthers, which was pretty shocking. But the Steelers game, they had control of that pretty much the entire way through. The rest of the schedule for them, I mean, it definitely matters. They were going to want to win these games against the Commanders, Cowboys, and Giants, but they're not the hardest games, which favors them. And I believe if they win out, they probably should get the number one seed. Again, don't know exactly how the tiebreakers work out in the NFC. But Philly looks to be playing some pretty damn good ball right now. Number one.
So I got Philly at the top. That's 10 in a row, the hottest team in football. And I think any late season game against Pittsburgh is going to challenge your team's toughness. And Philly completely shut them down. 163 total yards against them. Their last three games are against the three divisional rivals. I kind of like their chances right now. They should be feeling pretty good.
Number one for me, they're back at the number one spots, moving up one spot, is the Kansas City Chiefs. They are 13-1 with a 70 plus minus, which is really small for a team that's 13-1. I'd be curious to see 13-1 teams and all the 13-1 teams in NFL history and what their plus minus was. And I can pretty much guarantee you that the Chiefs would be at the lowest on that. Regardless, they do get their biggest margin of victory this past weekend against the Browns, 21-7. They dodged major injury with Mahomes. I believe he was a full practice today for them. And if he was, you know, out for a couple of weeks, if he was out for a couple of weeks, I probably would have put the Chiefs at number one. But with Mahomes healthy and Hollywood being healthy now as well too, they're in a good spot. I expect them to ramp it up over these next 3 weeks, and I would not want to be the Texans, Steelers, or Broncos because they are likely really going to kick it into gear now, as they have in the past 4 or 5 years now at this point. They know they're making the playoffs. They know they're going to win the division. It just matters to them to play good football in late December and throughout January and February. Moving on from that, though, we have something that we've been waiting to talk about for a long time, our CFP picks. We got four games this weekend that we wanted. You probably even wanted to give our picks last week, but we held back, resisted, and now we're giving in to the urge this weekend. Started off on Friday night, Indiana, number 10 goes into number 7, Notre Dame. It's supposed to be below freezing, potentially chance of snow. How do you think this game plays out, Skyler, and who do you think is going to win it?
Notre Dame's been on a mission ever since their loss to Northern Illinois with a rushing attack comparable to podcast favorites, Boise State and Army. But anybody can lose. This is college football, right? They're amateurs. Anything can happen. We just got to remind ourselves that. But I did not like the way Indiana looked in a couple close games against Michigan, and that bad loss against Ohio State just doesn't sit right with me. I got Notre Dame 31-17. They're going to run all over Indiana.
Yeah, I'm picking Notre Dame as well, too. I don't expect a crazy high-scoring game, which I think also favors Notre Dame as well, too. Indiana has allowed the least amount of rush yards per game in the FBS, but I don't think that's going to stop the three-headed horse of Jeremiah Love, Riley Leonard, and Jadarian Price. They're all averaging over 5.8 yards per carry. Love has 15 touchdowns. Leonard has 14 touchdowns on the ground, and Price has 7 as well, too. You just can't stop them. And on the other side of that, Curtis Rourke, who's had a good season for Indiana at their quarterback position, and only had 300-yard games against UCLA, Maryland, Northwestern, and Purdue. And in his toughest matchup this year against Ohio State, he went 8-for-18 with 68 yards. The Notre Dame defense is going to be firing as they have pretty much the entire season. I expect Notre Dame to win this game in, I would say, a landslide, because I don't think there's going to be a lot of points total because Indiana's got a good defense as well, too. But I do think it's a comfortable victory for the Fighting Irish. Moving on to Saturday morning, the 9 a.m. start time between number 11 SMU going in to Penn State to face the Nittany Lions. How do you think this one plays out?
SMU is a great underdog story. I'll be rooting for him here, but hypothetically, if Penn State's elite defense completely shut down the run game, just like the previous game we talked about, would anyone really be surprised here? Drew Aller's already committing to next season. That clears the air for the locker room. I assume the vibes will be up in the building. I'm still looking for my big first round upset, though. I just don't know if the Pony Express can pull this one off. I got a really close game, 26-23 Penn State.
Yeah. I think the Penn State offense definitely looked better in the second half of the season. That starts off with their quarterback, Drew Aller. With him going back to school, like you said, I completely agree there. I imagine that takes off some of the NFL stress for him and the team as well, too. Besides Drew Aller on their offense, they got a ton of talent, probably two top three-round picks in Nicholas Singleton and Tyler Warren, plus several picks in the NFL draft on the defensive side of the ball. For SMU, they're going to need to run the ball against tough defense. Breshard Smith, who's led the way for them this year with almost 1,300 yards, 14 touchdowns. But the real problem for me, I think, is going to be Kevin Jennings. He's had a slight turnover problem in recent games. Despite only having 8 interceptions on the year, he has 7 in their last 7 games. And I just don't think they have the talent on SMU's side comparative to what Penn State does through one through 52, 85, however many people they have on their roster technically. So I think Penn State wins. I don't think it's a crazy margin of victory, but I do think it's, again, another somewhat comfortable victory for the Nittany Lions. Sunday afternoon, depending on where you are in the country, I think is going to be Clemson versus Texas, a fun one. Can you call Texas the blue blood right now? I think you can kind of call Clemson in our college football lifetime history, but Texas has definitely, and maybe when we were younger, but this is an intriguing matchup for me. Who do you think comes out in this game?
So Texas is an 11.5 point favorite right now. That seems a little high until I remember the last two times Clemson played a top defense this year. A 31-point blowout loss against Georgia in their first game. And then, you know, that's okay. You get one. But the really ugly one is the 17-14 loss at home to the Gamecocks. I don't know what in the world is wrong with Quinn Ewers right now, but I bet you they score more than 2 touchdowns. Texas wins 27-16.
Yeah, I'll start off with Texas's team here. I think the offense has looked pretty bad since their first loss to Georgia. I talked about this last week, I believe, on the podcast. Outside of the Florida game, where Ewers had 333 passing yards and 5 touchdowns, since that first Georgia loss, he had 2 interceptions against Vandy, only 176 yards against Arkansas, only 191 against Kentucky, 219 in an INT versus TAMU, and 2 interceptions in this last game against UGA. I think the run game has multiple looks, but I don't think any of them are a dominant run force, whether that's Quintavion Wisner or Jaden Blue. And the defense is debatably the best in college football, but Clemson has had a stellar offense, especially in the second half of the season outside of that Carolina game that they had at the end of the regular season. On the Clemson side of the ball, Kate Gordon has been dominant ever since that first loss to Georgia, the week one neutral site game. He had 262, 4 touchdowns and no interceptions in that ACC championship game against SMU. Phil Maffa, 1,100 rushing yards this year. The defense is not great, but that offense for Texas doesn't surprise me either. My overall note in here is it's going to be a good Texas defense against a good Clemson offense and a mid-Texas offense against a mid-Clemson defense. And with how the picks are, I want to go Clemson, so I'm going to pick Clemson in this one. It's a big upset pick here.
I wanted to.
It all sets up Saturday night, though, for potentially the best matchup in this first round. We have number 9 Tennessee going to number 8 Ohio State. It's going to be a fun one. How do you think this plays out?
Yeah, what an epic first round matchup we get here. Another situation where the Ohio State -7 line doesn't fully express how evenly matched these two schools really are. But it's because Ohio State doesn't lose at home very often. That's probably why. I really think we could see a shootout, though, in this one, which is funny because both these teams got here because of their great defenses. I got Ohio State 38-35. If Tennessee plays from behind, they're not going to be able to run as much with Dylan Sampson. That's the X factor. And that's how we get the over if you're thinking about other possible bets here. But this is probably the closest one we're going to get to an upset so far. I just had a really hard time picking the underdogs in this round. I think we'll get a bigger one next round. because we'll be at a neutral site. But I feel like I still have to pick Ohio State at home.
I'll start off with the Buckeyes, and I'll start off with the quarterback, Will Howard, and the fact that we know exactly who he is at this point. He struggles versus top defenses and sometimes even struggles versus bad defenses, especially in this year. But the good thing for him is that he probably has the best weapons in college football. Running back, Quinshon Judkins and Travion Henderson is a legit nightmare duo. Quinshon at 5.5 yards per carry and Travion at 7 yards per carry. He's got two of the best wide receivers in college football as well, two of Jeremiah Smith and Emeka Egbuka, who's always an interesting name to say, despite us knowing his name for a long time now at this point. Also, the defense is debatably the top defense in college football. They allowed the least yards per game in the FBS as well as the least points per game in the FBS by, I believe, a 2 or 3 point margin. So it's by quite a bit there. On the Tennessee side, their offense is going to need to rely on the run game. Dylan Sampson, we know, is one of the best running backs in college football. He was ninth in the FBS in carries and rushing yards and fourth in touchdowns with 22. And Nico Amaleva, while he doesn't have the greatest offensive output, he does not turn over the football. So only with those 19 touchdowns, he's only thrown one pick in the last five games, which I think definitely means something for this Tennessee offense. I think Tennessee's defense, as we know, is one of the best groups in the SEC as well, too, probably just behind Clemson. They have a couple of NFL-level talents in there with James Pierce Jr. and Omar Norman Lott. I think some of the history for Ohio State as well, too, they don't lose at home often, but they're historically bad against SEC teams and can be on upset alert in this one. I'd expect this game to look similar to the Ohio State-Penn State game that we saw this year, where both quarterbacks weren't told to do much. Penn State, we know, relies on the run game. I think Tennessee does it even more. And I think Will Howard definitely relies on his playmakers as well, too. I do think Ohio State wins it, but it could be like 16-13 in my mind. I don't see it being a shootout.
It'll be fun either way.
Yeah, definitely. We could all be wrong, too, because that's college football. You never know in this sport. Things go the opposite ways, and people are more susceptible to the pressure than some other spots. So maybe Ohio State just boos Will Howard as he comes out the locker room, and it's all bad. But who knows? Moving on, though, we got MLB trade grades. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 trades that we're going to grade from both sides. Starting off with the one that we had earliest in the offseason, it's Brady Singer to the Cincinnati Reds for Jonathan India and Joey Weimer.
I'm going to give both sides a solid B. Singer and India are kind of aligned in a lot of ways here. They both have 2 more years of service time each, really good rookie years, then some struggles, and then finally trending back in the right direction before ultimately being traded for each other. Kansas City doesn't need the extra starter after building themselves a nice rotation. And Cincinnati has another infielder coming back in Matt McClain. This could either work out really well for both or we forget all about it, but there's not a lot of risk here.
Yeah, they're also very similar because they played on the same team at college, the Florida Gators. So I'll start off on Cincinnati's side. They trade from a strength to help a weakness, which I really liked. Bring in Brady Singer, a guy who's thrown over 150 innings pitched in the last 3 years with the ERA in the threes for two of those seasons. A bad 2023 season was mixed in there. He's a free agent after 2026, so 2 years of control. I like the move for them. I give this an A because I think what they're trading Jonathan India from is a large surplus of those middle infielder type guys that they have for Brady Singer, who's potentially a good 2 or 3 starter for them. On Kansas City side, I think they trade from somewhat of a strength as a starting pitching to add a huge weakness at the top of the order from guys that aren't named Bobby Witt, Vinny Pasquantino, or Salvador Perez. Starting pitcher in Kansas City seems to be a slight weakness now. With Singer gone. However, they do have Chris Bubich, who was effective out of the pen last year, and Alec Marsh at the back end, who was okay, pitching to, I think, like a 4.35 ERA or something like that. They hope Kyle Wright can solve one of those problems because he should be back in the 2025 season, but they really need India's bat to make this okay. I don't think Weimer trades or makes the club, so I don't really think that's going to that's going to affect it. But overall, I give Kansas City a B, and I think this trade helps both teams, but fits Cincinnati's roster a slight bit better. The next trade that we got was part of this flurry that will be these next seven trades that we had over like a 4 or 5 day span, starting off with Jake Berger to Texas for infielders Max Acosta and Edgerie Vargas, as well as starting pitcher Brian Mendoza.
For Texas, I'm going to give them a B minus for bringing in Berger. He definitely rakes 29 homers last year. He's definitely going to do some DHing for them. But Miami, is going to get the slightly higher B. I don't know too much about these three prospects. Looks like they're mostly high A ball guys, but Miami holds all the value in this move because they got Jake Berger for very cheap. I think it was Jake Eater, pitching prospect. So now they flipped a guy for three more guys to help the youth movement in Miami.
I'll start off with Texas. Berger becomes an instant DH with 800 OPS and 300 or not 300 homer, 30 homer possibility. One question mark is the Josh Smith role. Where does he go? Because it seems like every other spot on the diamond is pretty locked up. So I think he again becomes a whoever, whenever, wherever type of guy for that team. As far as Berger goes, he's a free agent after 2028. So he got 4 years of control. And because of that, I'm giving this an A+. I don't think the guys that they gave up are particularly crazy. I'll go over them now, though, on Miami's side. Starting off with Vargas, Edgerie Vargas. Interesting first name. I've never seen that before. Middle infielder, had a good season, a low A last year. Seems to be kind of an all-around type of guy. Max Acosta had a good season in double A. Has less pop than Vargas, but also strikes out way less and seems to be a bit of a better fielder. And then Mendoza, who comes in at 29 out of 30 on the Marlins' top prospects list, according to Pipeline as of right now. He started games in low A and high A in 2024, is a lefty that has a 60-grade changeup, so a pretty MLB-level changeup there. Overall, I give Miami a C. That's because I think Berger could have been a part of the future, and they really didn't need to make this trade. I've always been a fan of having the MLB talent over having the prospects' possible talents. And Miami trades their last proven bat in the lineup for prospects that aren't even stellar, but do have some good upside. So I don't love it for Miami, but I do love it for Texas because can't have enough bats, regardless of how many that you have. And we saw that last year with all the injuries they went under and some of the underperformances as well, too. Next trade here. This is a big one, so stay with me here. It's not a three-team deal. It's technically two trades that we kind of just mix into one because it happened with both players and in the same night. So we'll start off with the Toronto Blue Jays, who got Andrés Giménez and Nick Sandlin. Then the Pirates got Spencer Horwitz. And then the Cleveland Guardians got Luis L. Ortiz, Josh Hartle, Michael Kennedy, who are both minor league starters, and then minor league outfielder Nick Mitchell.
So I'll start off with Cleveland first because I have the highest grade for them, an A, because they're clearly getting ready for the future. They clear a spot here for Travis Bezanna at second. And the flip here, you're grabbing three pitchers from a pretty good pitching factory and bringing them over to another. So I like that a lot for Cleveland. Next for Pittsburgh, I have a B+. Horwitz raked in a small sample size for Toronto. They had a 125 OPS plus for him this year. And the Buccos really have nothing to lose when it comes to taking shots to help the lineup. So I'm okay with this. And then Toronto gets the average B grade. We know that Toronto can handle that Giménez contract at least. I do like Nick Sandlin. I just don't think this team has any direction right now, which could lead to an ugly rebuild where you're trading this guy for 10 cents on the dollar next year. So we'll see how this all fits for Toronto. That's kind of the question mark here. But I like the Cleveland and Pittsburgh part a lot.
Yeah. I'll start off with Toronto, where they got Andrés Giménez, who's under contract through 2029, with about a 15.2 AAV there. He's one of the best defensive players in the league, but the bat has been below average for two seasons now at this point. Even with that poor hitting performance the last 2 years, he posted a 3.8 war with a 96 WRC plus in 2023, and then a 2.8 war with an 83 WRC plus in 2024. So even with his bad offensive performance, he's still a very productive baseball player. And when he does hit, he instantly becomes one of the most impactful players in baseball. We saw that in 2022. I think he had a 140 WRC plus and had like a 6.1 WAR. So having a 6-WAR season is straight up ridiculous at the second base position. Regardless, it makes no sense for the Blue Jays to add this guy. Like, they traded Horwitz, who was one of their better prospects, even though he's 27. Like, Toronto doesn't have a good farm system to start with, and it got worse from this. Jimenez, who I would like on a winning team, is not a guy I would like on a losing team, and I think that's what Toronto is right now, especially now that they didn't get Soto and they didn't get Ohtani last year, and Vladdy Jr. is going into a contract season, and Bo Bichette just had a down year. There's a lot of moving pieces that I just don't like, and it's a big contract. I would have held back from them, so I give them a C plus because I do still think Jimenez can be a really good player. For Pittsburgh, they only get one guy, Spencer Horwitz, but he's a very intriguing bat with 6 years of control. Like I said, he's already 27, but in his first big league, real big league season last year, he posted a 127 WRC plus. He fits a need that the Pirates had and instantly becomes an upper half of the lineup bat for Pittsburgh. And they mainly only gave up Luis L. Ortiz, who was good for them last year, but would have battled for a spot in that rotation with the amount of arms that they have. So I give Pittsburgh an A on this one. I think they did really good. Last one is Cleveland. I'll start off with Luis L. Ortiz. He had a surprisingly pretty serviceable year for the Pirates last year. 4.28 expected ERA over 135 innings with the 7.1 K.9. The stuff won't blow you away, but he's a good enough starter for Cleveland, and I think that means something a lot for them. Kennedy and Hurdle are both left-handed starters that are strikingly similar, who don't throw ridiculously hard, throw strikes, and rely on their sliders to get outs. And then Mitchell is an undersized left-handed outfielder who was 136th pick in this draft this past year and has a solid bat and decent speed. So I give Cleveland an A- because I don't think they gave up a ton in the grand scheme of things. And getting Jimenez's contract out really meant a ton for them. So overall, Blue Jays receive a player that will be productive despite not the roster being in an adding situation. Pirates had a bat while not losing much, and Cleveland transitions a second base position. So a clear spot for Travis Pizzano, the number one overall pick, opens up. Next one. Perhaps the biggest one, I would say, as far as players, impactful players moving back and forth, it's Garrett Crochet and Carlos Narvaez to the Boston Red Sox for Kyle Teal, Braden Montgomery, Chase Medrath, and starting pitcher Wilkman Gonzalez.
I'm going to give Boston an A. They got their guy just like the last time they made this exact trade with Chicago. And that one worked out pretty well for another lefty and Chris Sale. Chicago did get a pretty nice package again. I'm going to give them the slightly worse A- grade just because prospects are never a guarantee. We saw last time Moncada started off on fire, and then he ended up being one of the least valuable of the group that they got. But Teal, Montgomery, they should be in the middle of that lineup pretty soon. I got the A for Boston getting the ace. A-, pretty good haul for Chicago.
Yeah, I'll start off with Boston. Instant ace for them. No disrespect to Tanner Houck, but he's no Garrett Crochet. He has some of the best stuff in baseball while being controllable for 2 years, which is hence the lofty return package. Going back to the White Sox, Crochet's 12.8 K/9, the 2.0 walks per nine is beyond elite. The expected numbers hold up as well too. 2.83 expected ERA and a 2.38 expected FIP are, as what I quoted, oh my God numbers. It has stuff to be a top three starting pitcher in the league, perhaps. I give it an A- because it does kind of suck giving up Kyle Teal. I think he would have really fit well into that second half, or not second half, but future lineup for the Red Sox. Regardless, on Chicago's side of it, Chicago builds their farm system in the best possible way. I'd expect Kyle Teal to be in the MLB at some point in 2025. Braden Montgomery might take a couple of years due to the injury he suffered last year, but that won't affect the MLB team too much anyways because they probably won't be good until 2027 or 28. The top six in their farm system now becomes very impressive. Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith, likely their top two starters for years to come. Kyle Teal and Colson Montgomery in the middle of the order should be there as soon as 2025. Like I said, Edgar Cuero, who they got for Giolito, I want to say, from the Angels last year, I'm less sure about, but it's still 21 and almost that will be ready and seems to be a good bat. I give Chicago an A+ here. This is a huge package. I didn't think that they'd get one of the top four prospects from Boston because they're all very elite at the top, and they got number two or number three and then also number five with Brandon Montgomery. So I think they did really good there. But Boston did what they had to do to get a potential Cy Young. So I understand it from both sides. I think they did a really good job. And one last note, with Chris Sale going to the Red Sox and Crochet going to the Red Sox, I guess it means that Noah Schultz or Hagen Smith will be on their way there next. In 6 years as well, too. Yeah. So expect Chicago's players to be Boston's players in 4 years, I guess. The switching of the Sox. Overall, good trade for both sides. Next up, we got Devin Williams going to the Yankees for Nestor Cortez and Caleb Durbin.
I'm going to give the Yankees an A for grabbing Devin Williams here. It's a really quick replacement for Clay Holmes because we know how great Devin Williams can be when he's healthy. It's just a matter of if. Milwaukee, it's weird what's going on in Milwaukee, that's for sure. But I'm still going to give them a B grade because if anyone can get the most out of a deceptive lefty, it's the Brewers. But I'm sure a lot of people envision Devin Williams having a much longer stint with the Brew Crew, who I believe is a rental too, but we'll see what happens. Obviously, the Yankees are in a win now move. They've made a lot of big moves, and another one today we'll get to.
Yeah. Do want to say that the Falcons just benched Kirk Cousins mm-hmm. for Michael Penix. Got that a few minutes ago. We'll talk more about that after these trades maybe and our thoughts on that. But I do kind of want to stay on topic here. I'll start off with the Yankees. They add one of the best closers in baseball for 1 year because he's a free agent after the season. He strikes out quite literally everyone. 15.8 K per nine in 2024 is ridiculous. And it adds to a already strong back end of the bullpen with Luke Weaver. Although I did give it a slightly lower grade than what most people probably would expect, the B+, just because I think Cortez is better than what the Yankees kind of valued him, and they kind of force traded him because they got Max Fried, which I don't really like. But on Milwaukee side of it, I think Cortez fits into the rotation perfectly. They needed guys that were reliable really badly. As we talked about in July, August, September, whatever month it was, pretty much all of them, I didn't like Tobias Myers, Colin Ray to be your number two and number three starters in a playoff series. And I mean, it kind of didn't work because of Devin Williams choking at the end there, but still, like, Cortez is better than Tobias Myers and Colin Ray. He threw 174 innings in 2024 with a 3.77 ERA with an expected ERA even lower than that. He's also a free agent after the 25 season, just like Devin Williams. I do think he is probably the more valuable player in terms of WAR over Devin Williams this year, so that's kind of a shocker, I guess. I don't think people would have expected that. Caleb Durbin, the other guy that they got, contact heavy bat, who walks at a higher clip than he strikes out, which is pretty encouraging. He doesn't have a ton of power, but has the ability to play all around the diamond, which the Brewers have shown to love in some of their other guys like Tyler Black and Bryce Terang as well, too. So kind of repeating my words, but I do want to have this note here that I typed out. Overall, Brewers loser closer, but have the great ability to find effective relievers as they have with some of the other dudes that they've tried out in the back end of the bullpen, whether that was when Devin Williams was hurt or some other times as well, too. The Yankees sell Cortez out of emotion because of the World Series performance for a closer who is dominant, but possibly could have issues with the media in New York, as some people have already talked about there. Him having some problems with the Milwaukee media, I guess. And if you have problems with the Milwaukee media, you're probably not going to do the greatest in New York. But still, I don't want to feed into that narrative too much. I still think both teams are good. Milwaukee gets an A. New York gets a B+.
I agree. Another trade based off of emotion, 100%.
Yeah. Next up, another big trade here. We have Kyle Tucker going to the Chicago Cubs for Isaac Paredes, Hayden Wesneski, and third baseman 2024 first-round pick Cam Smith.
Yeah, I got to give the Cubs an A for this one because Kyle Tucker has been an elite player for a while now. And we know just how much
a rental outfielder can do with that one season. Look at the Yankees, what Juan Soto did. You know, I think anything's possible in 1 year. So I'm not going to knock the grade on that one. Houston, I know he's a rental, but if it definitely feels like a B plus return for an A plus player still. Paredes should be fine in that ballpark. It all comes down to Cam Smith, in my opinion. I've seen grades all over the place with this guy, but he did dominate at Florida State. That's what I know for sure. Just half a season of minor league ball. We got to wait and see what happens with this, if they can re-sign him.
Yeah, I'll start off with the Cubs. They get one of the best players of baseball in a contract here. And if we've seen anything over the past like 4 or 5 years, you want that really good player in their contract year because they usually end up doing some remarkable things. But this move needs to result in winning because if it doesn't, Tucker's gone, and so are some of your best young players in Paredes, Wesneski, and Cam Smith. So, unfortunately, I don't think the Cubs are going to be that good of a team even with Kyle Tucker. I know they could maybe sneak into a playoff spot, but I don't think they're a World Series caliber team. So I give this move a C, shockingly for them. On Houston's side, I think they did great because they didn't feed into the emotional factor. They fed into the how are we going to get the most wins possible. It would have been nice, you know, have that extra year of Kyle Tucker, but when he walks and you don't get anything for him, that's what's really going to suck. Here they get Paredes, who is going to fill Bregman's spot at third base most likely and is controllable through 2027. His pull side swing fits perfectly, probably the best in the MLB with the short porch in left field. Payne Wisniewski is a guy who I liked when the Cubs got him from the Yankees, I want to say. And could end up being a starter, but definitely has the ability to be successful on the back end of a bullpen as well, too. And then Cam Smith, who instantly becomes Houston's number one prospect. Like I said, the 14th pick in the 2024 draft kind of seems like the full package at third base and is only 21 years old, so the sky's the limit with him. We've seen Houston turn some pretty bad prospects into some pretty good prospects. So when they get a great prospect, you can only imagine what they're going to do with him. Overall, the Cubs add that MVP level player in what becomes a must-win year for them. Houston makes a tough but smart move for longer-term success, not sex. That was awful. Since signing Tucker seemed unreachable. So I give Houston an A in this one. Chicago gets a C. So kind of flip-flop grades there. But yeah, we'll see who ends up being the smarter one here.
If Tucker goes and signs with Boston, it becomes an immediate A-plus for Houston. Of course.
Exactly. But if Tucker, you know, signs a 12-year deal back with the Cubs and it's because they made a playoff spot or something like that and he enjoyed Wrigley in August or something like that, then it's completely worth it. So we'll just have to wait and see. But nobody's determining a winner on December 17th before any of these players have played a game for the squads. Next up, we got Jeffrey Springs and Jacob Lopez going to the A's for Joe Boyle, Will Simpson, and Jacob Waters.
I got a solid B plus for both sides here. I love a good high risk, high reward trade when it's two teams that are used to this kind of thing. You know, Oakland hopes to revitalize Jeff Springs' career very similarly to a fellow lefty, Brett Anderson. I've made that comparison to you a couple times, and I'm sticking by it. If we can bring back an old Brett Anderson and get him back to all-star shape, I guess they can fix any lefty crafty pitcher, just like Milwaukee. And then Tampa, of course, too. They get a filthy new piece to add to the pitching staff, Joe Boyle. I was a fan, obviously. We may not have all the time in the world to rebuild him before he gets his dream shattered in Sacramento. So good for him. I'm happy he's in a comfortable environment.
Field playing the games for the A's though. I'll start off with them. Springs becomes a second starting pitcher added by the A's this offseason. When healthy, he's really good and looks to be that way after an injury riddled 2023 and 2024 campaign. Coming off of Tommy John, his contract goes through 2027 with a club option for that 27 year. So could be 2 years if he's bad. If he's not, then you got an extra third year of him for pretty cheap as well too. I give the A's an A here because it fits. The A's are A. And I think this actually is a good move for the state of the team because of the project that Joe Boyle is. And I'll talk about that right now with the Rays. He's the perfect Rays pitcher. He has great stuff, but terrible, terrible, terrible command and a problem that definitely needs fixing. But if the Rays do fix him, he becomes a possible ace. The other prospects, Will Simpson, I think, could be an MLB level bat someday. Jacob Waters, I don't know, maybe he finds a way into a bullpen at some point, but I don't think too much of him. This trade is about Boyle, but as far as the A's situation goes, like, the A's weren't going to rebuild this guy. They tried to last year. It didn't work. And they said, you know what, let's cut our ties right now while we still can and get a guy who's pretty good in Jeffrey Springs. Obviously, Tampa Bay has the ability to turn him into something great. That's why I gave him a B+, and not, you know, a D for acquiring a 6-ERA pitcher or whatever he was. But I think it was a necessary move for the A's to make, and a solid move for the Rays to make as well, too, and taking a flyer on Joe Boyle. I think the more realistic thing for him is to become a back end of the bullpen guy that throws 100%. Really hard and is really effective for an inning or two, because I can't see him being a starter right now with how much the A's tried to do stuff with him, and it just didn't work as far as stuff went with. So B+ for Tampa, A for the A's. Last trade that we got, interesting one as well, too, as Cody Bellinger goes to the Yankees for Cody Petit. And that's it.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's going to argue here. The Yankees clearly win this trade from an assets perspective here. They can afford the Bellinger deal. This is nothing to them. And this is a guy, too, who at one point was 100% a superstar player in this league. He's going to benefit from the short porch and right. So, of course, I'm going to give the Yankees an A. They kind of had to do this. All the other stuff they did before, a little confusing. But this is an A move. We'll go to the Cubs now. Petit has basically been the number 6 starter for these guys for the past couple of years, or at least 1 year with the Yankees. He's not bad, but we're going to have to come back to this one in a year and find out where Kyle Tucker went, because with this newfound cap space, anything's possible. I still have the C+ here for the return, but obviously multiple years of Kyle Tucker would help.
I give the Yankees an A. This one seems pretty easy. The Yankees get an extremely high upside guy that has seen some inconsistency with the bat over the last 5 years, but his power plays well in the Yankee Stadium and can be a potential 30-homer guy. His player option for 2026, so maybe there for 1 year, maybe there for 2 years, maybe there for longer. Who knows at this point in time. One bad thing with Cody Bellinger is that sometimes he goes on these terrible slumps, and at 27.5 mil per year, and with how ruthless that Yankee crowd could be and the media can be, it could be really tough for Cody Bellinger if he starts off in April hitting 160 with a homer or two. Then we saw Joey Gallo, it just kind of ruined his mental state getting booed up there every single time. And I would say he's recovered from it at all, because he hasn't really found an everyday role since in the MLB, but it can be really tough on players. And we've seen that with multiple guys. We saw it with Giancarlo Stanton when he was first the Yankee. He got booed, like, I think like a week and a half in after signing him or something like that. We saw it with a ton of other players as well, too. Sonny Gray, Frankie Montas, some A's players. But Cubs side, fucking F, man. Like, this sucks. You get rid of the contract that you don't like, but you just traded for Kyle Tucker. You needed to go win this year. Cody Bellinger has helped you win for back-to-back years. And I know you didn't really have a spot for him, but there's other guys you could have moved to find a spot for Cody Bellinger. Seiya Suzuki, I think, was kind of the clog in the machine at this point, because he has that no-trade clause, and I guess he didn't want to get traded or something like that. So he's kind of in that like Eric Hosmer situation when he got dealt to the Nationals or the Red Sox or whatever in that weird Juan Soto trade. I like it for the Yankees. I don't like it all for the Cubs. And I'm not trying to be a Cubs hater here, because I gave both trades a bad grade, but it's not good. I didn't like what they did this offseason, so they get an F on this one.
I think that
Suzuki possibly being moved, and then a mid-season big Tucker extension, in my mind, is what's holding the C+. It's because I still think it's possible, but obviously not the ideal return.
Yeah, I think the days of players getting that mid-season extension, though, are probably in the past. Especially, let me see, who is Kyle Tucker's agent? Because if he's Boris, then he is a one-year Cub. He is represented by... he's not a Boris client on Cubs Reddit. That's literally what I said. That's funny. represented by XL Sports Management. Same agent that reps Dansby Swanson. Yeah. I don't know. He's going to get a lot of money regardless. Yeah. So there's that. Anyways, moving on from that, we'll move into the second half and the mock draft.
Yeah. Well, we can kick it off with some Michael Penix Jr. talk.
Oh, yeah.
Congrats to him, man. He deserved it. Kirk Cousins looked like garbage last night.
That's true. Yeah, I was saying this, I believe, to you during the game last night, where it just felt like the Falcons were content with their 15 points. They didn't want to do anything on offense. They just kind of handed the ball off to Bijan, and if he didn't get the first down, they punted or kicked a field goal. And it almost cost them the game, and if it cost them the game, it would have cost them their season. So I do like the soft landing for Michael Penix, even in a playoff scenario, because they do play the Giants. They play the Commanders, and then I believe they play the Panthers after that. So pretty easy defenses to go up against. And he's got all the weapons in the world. Like, he's got a good running back. He's got a good wide receiver. He's got good tight end. So good for Michael Penix. But Kirk Cousins, man, this is just not the way I expected to go out for him.
Well, all right. I do have a mock draft. I think this is technically 5.0 at this point. I've been trying to keep track of my spreadsheets, but we got a brand new top 10, so let's run through the top 10 here. The Raiders at the top, baby. Congratulations, Shedeur Sanders at the top. That just, it seems like the one guy they've been linked to all season long. And kind of the same with number two, New York. Now we're seeing some more reports come in about New York and Shedeur Sanders, but I kind of have to say, at least with the guys who are still employed there, they've definitely been linked to Cam Ward. It seems like this is going to be the top two right here. New England is ecstatic. They get Travis Hunter because they got a big need at corner and receiver. There's so many tackles that they could get away with not taking one in the first round here. So Travis Hunter seems like he'd work. They'd let him play receiver too, you know. At number four, Jacksonville kind of gets screwed with Travis Hunter gone, but they're just going to sit and take the best lineman. I have Will Campbell, LSU. Some rumors about being a guard, but I'm just going to wait until we get to the combine because we don't really know what his actual size is until we get there. That's a big LSU left tackle to Jacksonville. At number five, Carolina, I really like the way that Bryce Young's been playing, and they kind of accidentally leaked that they're looking at edge rushers. So I really don't know how to separate these guys right now, but right now the media's got Abdul Carter at the top of that edge list. Penn State, we'll get to see him this weekend. Against SMU. So we'll see if he's a game wrecker there. That'll be an interesting fit. That helps out Tennessee, who really wants Tet McMillan, I'm sure. They need another big receiver. Quarterback is going to be a question mark, but hey, if the next guy is Jalen Milroe, just trade up to 28 and take him there. Because I'm sorry, Cleveland and Jets Milroe fans, that's just not going to happen. You have bigger needs there. That's why I got seven Cleveland taking Kelvin Banks, the big tackle from Texas. Doesn't matter who's playing quarterback. If you don't protect them, if you're not able to run the ball, it's not going to happen. We'll see how DTR looks, though. That'll be interesting. Probably not a long-term answer, but better than Watson at this point. At eight, the Jets, I kind of mentioned it earlier. We're going to be looking in the trenches, specifically for the first round, I have to guess. And again, hey, Rodgers may not show up next year, and that changes the whole strategy. But I love Mason Graham to the Jets. They're still trying to look to fill that JFM role. I love John Franklin Myers. He's tearing things up with Denver, but he's gone, man. Got to replace him. At number nine, another sneaky tackle pick here for the Bears. Josh Simmons from Ohio State was at one point ranked really high out of high school recruiting, but he's been dealing with injuries. He's now back looking pretty good. And to close it out, number 10, New Orleans Saints. They've taken so many tackles that I didn't go back to back here. I haven't taken defense. Jalen Walker linebacker Georgia. It's kind of the new age of the edge rusher, right? Will McDonald went 15, and everyone's like, wait, what, a 240-pound guy in the first round? What are you doing? He's looked pretty good. That's kind of how I see Jalen Walker. Plus, he's out of Georgia. He's going to be coached up. And they re-signed all their receivers already. I do have Genty still to the Cowboys. Scroll down the list. Washington, we've mentioned maybe they grab an extra receiver. Luther Burden slips to them in this scenario. And D linemen for the Lions and Chiefs right now. They don't have a whole lot of needs, but I don't see any crazy receivers going at the end of the first round either. That's probably going to be your edge rusher or quarterback trade up spot. So many good edge rushers in this class. It's going to be fun because we saw the past couple of years, they slipped a bit. So there's the mock draft. I can't wait to get even deeper when we can watch these guys play either in a playoff game or in an all-star game format. All right. You got anything to add to that? All right. Well, next thing I got, transfer portal. It's already open, right? We haven't even played playoff games, and the transfer portal fully open and taken over right now. So far, Ole Miss has been the busiest school to kick things off. They've grabbed four former five stars who haven't gotten their shot. But until things are official, I'll stick to quarterback talk now because there's some good quarterbacks who've already moved. We'll start things off with Connor Wiegman, Texas A&M. He'll be going to Houston. He'll be able to rewrite the story in an air raid offense, or maybe NFL scouts looking at it, some bad film from A&M, and do something similar to what Kyle McCord did, rewrite the story like he did at Syracuse, but at Houston this time. Another guy with a down year was Miller Moss from USC. He's going to be going to Louisville. Another guy who didn't really have that breakout season he was hoping for, moving into that more offensive friendly environment. I had Miller Moss as a fourth rounder comparable to a Brock Purdy after they beat LSU, but he didn't finish strong. So we just got to wait and see. A guy not a lot of people have talked about, it's Darian Mensah from Tulane. He's going to Duke. The redshirt freshman was a pleasant surprise for the Green Wave this year, but it looks like he was possibly using that developmental school to propel into a bigger conference, not really stay around. So we'll see what he could do with a slightly better team around him. There's a few other guys I wanted to mention, too. They haven't signed yet, but they do have rumors. So we'll start off with John Mateer. Amazing year at Washington State. And here's the dark side of our most recent realignment is the most talented quarterback on the West Coast is now out. He's rumored to have a meeting with Oklahoma. We talked about this last night. Seems like a pretty good fit. A little veer and shoot over there. Great athlete. The next guy's a similar situation here. Fernando Mendoza from Cal. Like I said, similar story. He's from Miami. He played well against them on primetime. And the rumor is he goes back home to take Cam Ward's spot. I would love that for a former Cal player and be disappointed that one of their better quarterbacks is leaving once again. This time it's just not for the NFL. It's for a different school, man. Another guy who, oh, we actually do know where this guy's going. Excuse me, Jackson Arnold. He has chose Auburn, the former Oklahoma Sooner. Rough first year, but my problem with this isn't with Arnold himself to figure it out. It's Auburn. Auburn has failed over and over again at developing these decent quarterbacks and just not even getting close to getting drafted. So I worry for Jackson Arnold, but he does have three more years to figure it out. And then the last guy I want to talk about, Malik Murphy, was a backup at Texas, pretty good year at Duke, and now he wants his shot in the SEC. He's already got visits with Kentucky and Alabama lined up. Plus, I'm sure Georgia would be willing to give him a call if Gunnar Stockton or Carson Beck don't play well in the playoff. So there's been probably 1,000 players to hit the portal so far. These are just 10 of the ones who play the most important position. And I'm sure we're going to have a lot more time to talk about them. But that is the second half for me. Thought we should talk about some portal news because it kind of flies under the radar. Sometimes you flip on ESPN2 the next year and you're like, whoa, the Cal quarterbacks at Miami? How did that happen? Like, it's cool.
Yeah. And I did also see, I know it's not a quarterback, but yeah. Zachariah Branch entered the portal, which mm-hmm. is a big one.
Yeah.
He's got SEC kind of written all over him, right? You'd imagine?
I would imagine so. If it's not Oregon, right?
That would be cool. Yeah, it's probably going to be Oregon, let's be real. But Moving on to our list, bold predictions. Obviously, transfer portal just now opening officially, I think, technically. But going to be some crazy stuff going on there. I couldn't imagine being a playoff coach right now, having to recruit and also tell your own players to stay while also trying to win games that really, really matter. Anyways, last week on our layups section did not go good. 0-2 there. Carolina minus 2.5 did not hit. Detroit minus 2.5 did not hit either. This week, I didn't have a single one that I went with. So I went with Penn State and Notre Dame win. I guess you can make that a parlay, I think, together. It ends up being like minus 150, minus 130. So around there, I think those two teams are my locks to win, though.
Yeah, kind of an odd week, specifically for the playoffs. Not a lot of close ones here, but I did stick with the one pick for my layup. That was the Notre Dame minus 7 line. I'm okay with that one. Indiana hasn't proven a thing. I love Curtis Rourke's story, but you got to remember, this guy played in the MAC for 3 years. I don't think he's going to be ready for a Notre Dame playoff game on the road.
Yeah. Bold predictions last week actually went well for us. We went 2-for-2, so you would have plus money if you placed all four bets. I had Tampa Bay over the Chargers at plus 135. Skyler had the Rams at plus 120 over the Niners on Thursday Night Football. This week, at plus 300-something odds, I decided to go with Clemson. You know, maybe don't put $1 billion on this one, but if you put $10 to $15 on this one, I like our chances here for Clemson to pull off an upset victory in what would be the widest upset in this first round.
So for my bold prediction, I'm going to do the two-pick thing here because I didn't find a good money line I liked. And my first pick's an FCS game. I got the Dakota Classic, I guess. I don't know what their actual rivalry is called, but in the second round of the FCS playoffs, it's going to be North Dakota State hosting South Dakota State. North Dakota is an underdog. They haven't been their normal dominant self, and they don't do money lines in the FCS. So I'm going to add Kansas City to this one. The Chiefs, they're going to beat Houston. Obviously, there's some rumors about the ankle of Patrick Mahomes, but if you can get Kansas City on a good deal, which is they're not plus odds, but I think they're like a minus 105 and Houston might be like a minus 115. So you combine those, maybe you win yourself $10.
Yeah, I was looking at our spreadsheet and it said NDSU over SDSU. I was like, San Diego State's playing. I was like, okay, that makes a lot more sense. Yeah. But that's going to do it for episode 223. Next week, 224, we'll know what happened in the first round of the college football playoff, which will be cool to see. We'll hopefully have some more MLB stuff to go over, some NFL stuff to go over, of course. I don't know, maybe basketball. I feel like I said every week, maybe basketball, and it never comes up. But NBA Cup's on right now, so there's that. Anyways, you got any parting notes, Skyler?
I'm just excited to see who Boise's going to face in the Fiesta Bowl.
It's true.
Big game and a great time to be a Bronco fan.
Boise or Western Michigan.
No. Well, all right. We got 224 next week. We're going to preview the second round games, Fiesta Bowl, Rose Bowl, Cotton and Sugar. Along those lines. We'll get to it next week, but until then.
Yeah, see you in the next one.